Welcome to the Skeptic's Guide to Emergency Medicine. Meet 'em, greet 'em, treat 'em, and street 'em. Today's date is September 8th, 2016, and I am your skeptical host, Ken Milne. The title of today's podcast is, Oh Baby, You're Too Sensitive, High Sensitivity Troponin. And our guest skeptic today, to start, season number 5. Yes, that's right. Season number 5 is Dr. Justin Morgenstern. Justin is an emergency physician and the director of simulation education at the Markham Stouffville Hospital in Ontario. He is the author of this excellent FOMED blog called First 10 EM and is an associate editor of Emergency Medicine Cases. Welcome back to the SGEM, Justin.
Thanks for having me, Ken. You know, I'm always happy to come and talk a little nerdy with you.
Well, I love talking nerdy. And this first episode of season number 5 is going to be an SGEM hot off the press with AEM. Justin, you are in the hot seat normally occupied by Dr. Chris Carpenter from WashU.
Well, it's an absolute honor to be here, but honestly, I'm a little bit nervous. I mean, this is Captain Cranium's chair, the man who literally wrote the book on evidence-based medicine, and I don't even have a nickname.
Well, he did write a book on EBM, but Chris has become the deputy editor of AEM, and he is very, very busy. So the torch has been passed to you, Justin.
Well, I absolutely love the SGEM Hot Project, and I'm thrilled to be part of the team. I think it's just going to keep getting better as we go along. But honestly, I'm looking down at my feet right now, and these are some really big size 16 shoes that Chris has left to fit me for me to fill.
Don't panic. We are going to rotate this big responsibility you have with another guest skeptic, Dr. Corey Heitz. More of that in a minute, though. But let's review the 5-step SGEM hop process first, Justin.
Absolutely. So step number 1 is to pick a pre-publication paper.
Yeah, we get a list of papers coming up for publication in AEM or CGEM that have been peer-reviewed and, via consensus, pick one that we think will be of interest to the SGEMers.
Step 2 is to do a structured critical review of that paper.
Yeah, and we use a checklist developed by the best evidence in emergency medicine, or the BEAM group.
Step 3, my favorite part, is to discuss that paper with one of the authors.
And we have one of the authors here today, and this gives us a deeper, richer understanding of both the strengths and the weaknesses of the paper.
And then step 4 is to post a blog and podcast when the paper gets published.
And we're going to encourage the FOMED world to engage with us and the author over a 1-week time period.
And then finally, step 5, a summary of the critical review and the best social media engagement is then published in Academic Emergency Medicine, or CGEM.
And this brings that whole world of traditional publication together with FOMED to help cut that knowledge translation window down from over 10 years to less than 1 year.
And is there some exciting new feature added to the SGEM Hop episodes with Academic Emergency Medicine?
Oh, that's right. Wait for it. Boom! We have arranged CME credits to be attached to the AEM SGEM Hop episodes. And here to explain how this is going to work is Dr. Corey Heitz. Welcome to the SGEM, Corey.
Thanks, Ken. Really glad to be here. I'm really excited about this new way to add even greater benefit to the readers of Academic Emergency Medicine and listeners of the podcast by linking with the SGEM Hot Off the Press.
Well, just so people know a little bit more about you, Corey, you're an associate professor of emergency medicine at the Virginia Tech Carilion School of Medicine at Roanoke, Virginia. In addition, Corey is the CME editor for Academic Emergency Medicine and the associate editor for Emergency Medicine Simulation at the AAEM MedEd portal. But can you please explain how the SGEMers can claim their CME credits?
Sure, Ken. Well, the SGEM team, including you, Justin, and myself, are going to pick from the upcoming Academic Emergency Medicine articles the one which we'd like to highlight. Using a combination of our discussions of the evidence quality as well as a general idea of what's important from the article, I will write some CME questions and vet those through you guys. On the journal website, a link exists in the left-hand column under Special Features, which will take listeners to a site where they can register to answer these 5 questions and claim their CME credits. We're also going to post this link on the SGEM site and in the show notes.
Well, the plan is to alternate between Corey and Justin, who will be on the podcast and who will be doing the summary write-up to be published in AEM. Corey, is there anything else you want to say before Justin and I get started on this episode?
Well, Ken and Justin, it's great to be part of the team. I think this partnership will allow us to offer benefits to the SGEM listeners as well as further join the SGEM team with the folks over at Academic Emergency Medicine.
All right, we'll talk to you in a bit. Justin, can you give us a case?
A 53-year-old woman presents to your emergency department a little less than 2 hours after her anterior squeezing chest pain is at its peak. She has a history of hypertension, but is otherwise healthy. Thanks to a medical directive, when you sit down with the patient, she already has a normal ECG, and a high sensitivity to troponin T-test has come back below the limit of detection. She's feeling a lot better now and would like to go home.
Well, patients present to the emergency department with chest pain, and they're a daily conundrum. And there are a number of life-threatening conditions that must be efficiently ruled out.
Unfortunately, for the most common, acute coronary syndrome, there is no universally agreed-on algorithm. In addition to serial ECGs, a variety of different biomarkers are used and repeated at different intervals.
And these biomarkers may or may not be followed by admission or further outpatient provocative testing, depending on where you practice.
With the advent of high-sensitivity troponin tests, it has been argued that there are probably some patients in whom we can exclude the diagnosis of MI with just a single blood test.
And the SGEM has done a couple of episodes on high-sensitivity troponin in previous seasons. There was SGEM number 43, 1 is the loneliest number, and SGEM number 128, 1 hour AMI, rule out, rule in, harder, better, faster.
A recent systematic review determined that a single high-sensitivity troponin T below the level of detection resulted in a sensitivity of 97.4%, not bad, and a specificity of 42.4%.
When a non-ischemic ECG is added to a single negative high-sensitivity troponin, one retrospective study of more than 14,000 patients found a sensitivity for MI of 98.3% and a negative predictive value of 99.8%.
However, many of the existing studies are small, single-centered, and/or retrospective. So that leads us to this week's clinical question. Can a high-sensitivity troponin T level below the limit of detection on arrival in the emergency department be used to safely exclude acute myocardial infarction in patients with no ECG ischemia?
And to try to answer that question, we're very proud to have the lead author of the paper, Dr. Richard Boddy. Welcome to the SGEM, Rick.
Many thanks, Ken. It's a pleasure to be with you on the SGEM with my healthy appreciation of skepticism and, of course, cheesy music. I've always admired what you do.
Well, Rick is a professor of emergency medicine who leads the Emergency Medicine and Intensive Care Research Group in Central Manchester. His PhD was in the derivation of clinical decision rules for suspected cardiac chest pain and is currently chief investigator for the BEST study and the Manchester Acute Coronary Syndrome Trial. Rick is also a senior editor at the St. Emlyn's blog. Love the gang from St. Emlyn's, and an associate editor at Emergency Medicine Journal. Now, Rick, you and I, we've met a few times and even taught a critical appraisal workshop together at SMAC.
That's right, and I'll never forget the home-brewed SGEM beer that you gave me at SMAC Chicago. We don't have anything like that at St. Emlyn's, not yet, and I was very impressed.
Well, it is a pleasure to start season number 5 with you and your paper in AEM that is hot off the press. What is the title of the paper, and do you want to give a shout out to some of your co-authors?
Sure. The title of the paper is The Use of Very Low Concentrations of High Sensitivity Troponin T to Rule Out Acute Myocardial Infarction Using a Single Blood Test. It was a secondary analysis from a multi-center international study called TRAPID-AMI, and I was very lucky to collaborate with so many leading experts in this field from all around the world. It was led by Christian Müller from Basel in Switzerland. We also had Bertie Lindahl from Uppsala in Sweden and Evangelos Yiannitsis from Heidelberg in Germany. In fact, the list of co-authors really is a little bit of a who's who of research in this field.
Well, Rick, let's go through the PICO. What was the population you were investigating?
So we were looking at adult patients who presented to the ED with new onset chest pain or other symptoms that suggested they may have an ACS. And we were looking to get early presenters, so the symptoms had to have peaked within the last 6 hours.
So the exclusions were acute trauma, pre-hospital thrombolytic or revascularization, pre-hospital defibrillation or cardioversion, dialysis patients, patients who undergone cardiac surgery within 1 month of presentation, patients hospitalized for AMI in the previous 3 weeks, and pregnant or breastfeeding women. What was the intervention?
being a diagnostic study, the intervention was essentially an index test, and that index test was high sensitivity cardiac troponin T measured on arrival to the ED.
And what was your comparison or control?
Well, again, being a diagnostic cohort study, it wasn't essential that we had a comparator. And the aim of this study was really to report the accuracy of a strategy that we were interested in. So we didn't have a zero-hour test comparator here. There was, however, a reference standard to compare to.
Now, I'm going to ask you what the primary outcome was. And I want to remind you, when it comes to the primary outcome, there can only be one.
Our one primary outcome was acute myocardial infarction at the time of admission.
And your AMI was defined as using the third universal definition of patients who developed a rise and or fall of troponin with at least one value above the 99th percentile of a healthy reference population in the appropriate clinical context. And now for the secondary outcome, and you can have more than one.
So our main secondary outcome was the incidence of major adverse cardiac events, MACE. And in this study, we defined MACE as acute MI, that's either prevalent or incident within 30 days, death, or rehospitalization for an acute coronary syndrome with coronary revascularization occurring within 30 days of admission. And the other secondary outcome that's probably worth mentioning is more of a sensitivity analysis, I guess, than a secondary outcome. But we looked at what might happen if we diagnosed MI according to high sensitivity cardiac troponin T levels, rather than the other assay that we'd used for adjudication, which was a troponin I assay. So we looked to see whether we could predict a late troponin T elevation using the initial troponin level.
And Rick, what were your conclusions?
In the absence of ECG ischemia, the detection of very low concentrations of high sensitivity cardiac troponin T at admission seems to allow rapid, safe exclusion of an acute myocardial infarction in over one third of patients without the need for serial sampling. So this could be used alongside a careful clinical assessment to help reduce unnecessary hospital admissions.
All right, so let's go through a quality checklist with Justin then, and these are the ones for observational studies. Justin, question number one, did this study address a clearly focused issue?
Yes, it did.
And did the authors use an appropriate method to answer their question?
We were unsure here. A prospective observational study is reasonable, but this is a secondary analysis of data collected for a different primary purpose.
So we'll talk about that a bit more in the nerdy section. Question number three, was the cohort recruited in an acceptable way?
Yes.
Was the exposure accurately measured to minimize bias?
Yes.
And was the outcome accurately measured to minimize bias?
We're not sure here. They did use international definitions, but it still relies on the consensus diagnosis of two cardiologists. This will be discussed further in the nerdy section.
Question number six, have the authors identified all important confounding factors?
We were unsure because these are not consecutive patients. But that's one of the difficulties of research. They had to do it when the research nurses were available.
Was the follow-up of subjects complete enough?
Yes.
And how precise are the results?
They were good, but potentially borderline for clinical practice. The 95% confidence interval for the sensitivity of the primary strategy below the limit of detection was 95.3 to 99.5%.
Do you believe the results?
Yes, I do.
And do you think the results can be applied to the local population?
I'm unsure, Ken. The rule-in rate for MI at the initial visit in this study was 16.6%. While sensitivity is not impacted by prevalence, the negative predictive value is dependent on prevalence. So the negative predictive value will depend on your local prevalence of disease, but sensitivity will not.
So Corey, you're still on the line here. I'm going to bring you back in. 17% roughly. Is that reflect your local prevalence for MI?
Definitely not, Ken. I don't know our exact numbers, but from my personal clinical experience and given the triage protocols and other testing that we do in the U.S. and in our area, which results in numerous troponins being sent, I would be shocked if we were at 1%.
And Justin, what about you? You're in Canada.
I don't know my exact numbers, Ken. It might be a little bit better if I got to choose when the troponins were sent, but all these labs are sent from triage without me, so our number is probably in the low single-digit percents, 5% at most.
So question number 11, do the results of this study fit with other available evidence?
Yes, they do.
All right, so let's go through the key results. The analysis included a total of just about 1,300 patients. there was 213, or that 16.6%, were diagnosed with an acute myocardial infarction on their initial visit. The mean age was about 62 years, and about two-thirds being male. Now, Rick, I was going to bring you back in here because we thought this might be a good spot in the results section for you to briefly explain the difference between the limit of detection versus the limit of detection and the limit of blank.
Yes, because this, I think this is a good point to think about the index test. And the index test is high sensitivity cardiac troponin T. But what really matters is how we use the cutoff for high sensitivity cardiac troponin T. And the convention is that we use the 99th percentile in an apparently healthy population. That's the conventional upper reference limit. But in this study, we were looking to use an unconventionally low cutoff. And there are two obvious candidates for that. We could set that cutoff as low as we can possibly go. And that's to something called the limit of blank, which is essentially the highest result that we might reasonably expect to get if we measured a sample of water, which has no troponin in it. We might go a little bit higher than that, and we might go to something called the limit of detection. And that's essentially the lowest concentration that we might reasonably detect when there actually is some troponin there, and we might differentiate that from water. So we wanted to know what would happen if we set the cutoff that low, at the limit of blank or the limit of detection of the assay.
And so to remind everybody, what did you use in this study?
Our primary goal was to look at the limit of detection of the assay, which is 5 nanograms per liter for high sensitivity cardiac troponin T.
All right, let's get back to the key results. Justin?
Well, this is why I love talking to the authors, because I just learned so much. But in terms of the primary outcome of acute MI, using the primary strategy of an initial high sensitivity troponin T below the limit of detection and no ECG ischemia, the test characteristics are a sensitivity of 99.1% and a specificity of 43.9%.
And so that gave a positive predictive value of 26% and a negative predictive value of 99.6%.
But I would just remind everybody here that negative predictive value does look great, but it is dependent on prevalence. So these numbers give us a positive likelihood ratio of 1.76%, but a negative likelihood ratio of 0.02, which is well below that number 0.1 that we like to rule out disease.
And for the secondary outcome, that MACE, the total 30-day MACE for the primary strategy was 1.3%. And the actual numbers were 6 MACE events, including only 1 death, no AMI, and 3 revascularizations.
Now, you can find all these details on table number 4, but it is a little confusing. The numbers don't seem to add up initially because the incidence of MACE included AMI at presentation, as well as the secondary MACE events within 30 days, such as acute myocardial infarction, all-cause death, and coronary revascularization following rehospitalization. As you can imagine, some patients may have developed more than one major adverse cardiac event, such as a patient having an MI and needing revascularization.
Yeah, Justin, I think that's a very valid criticism. Sometimes you can look at a paper so often that you fail to see the obvious things. And I think we could have presented table 4 a little bit better with hindsight. What was missing is the incidence of, well, the prevalence of AMI initially. I think if we'd have included that column, it would have made a lot more sense to people. But it might also be important to take a moment to think about the outcome of revascularization. This is a subjective outcome, and our group actually had a lot of discussion about it. Some people are quite averse to using it as an outcome in diagnostic research like this. And I think you can see why. The rate of revascularization varies quite a lot by center. For example, in our study, Heidelberg has a very high rate of revascularization, which might be driven by their resources. They have a huge number of cath labs, and all patients are seen in bespoke chest pain units. So perhaps unsurprisingly, they have a huge incidence of revascularization in relation to some of the other centers in the study. However, some people think it is important to report revascularization. I think I'm one of those people. I like to see the incidence of revascularization. And one of the things that's important to notice about this study is that actually when you include in-hospital revascularization in the incidence of MACE, then the incidence of MACE at 30 days in patients who would have been ruled out using this strategy isn't actually that low. It's around about 3%.
All right. One of my favorite parts. Time to talk a little nerdy. And Rick, we're going to ask you 5 questions about your study to better understand and interpret the results.
Okay, I'm ready. Let's see if we can get through this.
Justin, you get to kick things off with the first question.
Yeah, so this was a secondary analysis of data collected for a different study, the International Multicenter TRAPID AMI study. Was this a pre-planned analysis, and how do you think this impacts your results?
So the question was actually set a priori, because I asked it at the first investigator meeting before we started recruitment and before the protocol had been finalized. The study design was exactly as I'd have made it if this had been the primary research question, although it is important to acknowledge it wasn't the primary research question.
So question number two, this is going to talk about the gold standard. And as always with these studies, there's a questionable gold standard. Acute myocardial infarction was based on two independent cardiologists using all the available clinical data. Now, they were blinded to the high sensitivity troponin results, as a different sensitivity troponin eye test was used clinically for all patients. And there is some degree of subjectivity with this process. Can you comment on this imperfect gold standard and how many times a third cardiologist was needed to be called in to adjudicate?
You're asking some tough questions now, Ken. I'm not actually sure how often the third cardiologist was required, but I'd be able to get hold of those data should anyone need it. However, I'm really quite interested in your suggestion that it's a questionable gold standard for acute MI. We had a lot of discussion about this at the first investigator meeting before that protocol was finalized, and I know a lot of thought went into it. So I guess I'd ask, how would we do it better? The diagnosis of acute MI is always a little bit subjective because you have to combine that troponin rise and or fall with the clinical context. And when you have to judge the clinical context, then really, you need an adjudication committee to do it robustly, and that's exactly what we did. I should mention, though, that we did run a sensitivity analysis, so that took out the subjectivity. And in that analysis, acute MI was defined as any late cardiac high sensitivity troponin T concentration above the 99th percentile without the need for any adjudication. And even with that purely troponin-based criterion, our results were actually essentially unchanged.
All right, great. So that brings us on to question number three, which is about the acceptable miss rate and potential medical legal implications. So you found a miss rate of 0.7% or 4 out of 560 patients with high sensitivity troponin T being used alone, or 0.4%, which was 2 out of 471 patients, if used with no signs of ECG ischemia. In addition, the MACE rate at 30 days was 1.3%, with most of that being revascularization. So what is an acceptable miss rate? And in addition, your paper mentions medical legal implications of using high sensitivity troponin T. Can you expand on that point?
Definitely. I think this is a key point. It's not the medical legal implications of using high sensitivity troponin T particularly. It's the medical legal implication of using this limit of detection rule out strategy that's the concern. I think the data show that we can rule out an acute MI with very high negative predictive value. But can we discharge all of those patients? I'm a little bit less confident about that idea because the incidence of MACE isn't negligible. So I'm not sure that we can stop thinking once the troponin is less than 5 nanograms per litre and the ECG is normal. Some of those patients may still need further investigation. And for some, I personally think that probably ought to be as an inpatient, at least until we get some good safety data from interventional trials.
It was really good to hear you explain it like that, because I think this is an issue that people are going to have. The fourth question is about ECGs. Rick, when do we ever evaluate a patient suspected of ACS without getting an ECG? And adding that ECG decreased the miss rate from 0.7% to 0.4%. However, one investigator retrospectively evaluated the ECGs and decided if it had any evidence of ischemia. Who was that one investigator? And did you consider having more than one individual interpret the ECG so inter-rater reliability could be determined?
Actually, that one investigator was a panel, but one person interpreted each ECG. In practice, I guess only one individual does interpret any one ECG, so it's at least pragmatic. And with 1,282 patients, I think it was as much a resource issue as anything else. Investigators reviewed the ECGs, but it was a very robust process. It was a pleasure to be part of it, actually. I was one of the assessors, and the ECGs came to us electronically with no details other than the trace. We were blinded to everything and simply had a case report form to fill out to record our interpretation. It might have been more pragmatic to use the treating clinician's interpretation, but this was at least a fairly robust way of recording the data. But I do agree that having some idea of inter-observer reliability would have been a strength of the study and would be good in a future study.
All right, on to our final nerdy question, number 5. The primary outcome of this study was acute myocardial infarction. We really like that you emphasized in your paper that clinicians must still use their clinical judgment. Can you comment further on the role you think clinical judgment plays in these cases?
Absolutely. I think it's really important that we don't stop thinking as clinicians. We should never read data about an algorithm and believe that we can simply follow that algorithm without any further thought. There will always be exceptions to rules. There'll always be unusual cases. The only way that we as clinicians can pick up those unusual cases is to keep thinking, to ask ourselves whether there's any reason to doubt the algorithm, to override it based on our clinical judgment. That's what evidence-based medicine was always supposed to be, the integration of the best evidence with our clinical judgment. You should never have one without the other.
Well, those are the 5 questions. Is there anything else you want to say about the study?
Well, being the S, Jem, S gets the emphasis in that sentence. It's just a thought, but do you think it bothers anyone that this study was industry-sponsored?
Well, I've said before that industry-sponsored studies do not make the results wrong, but it should make us more skeptical of the paper and the interpretation.
Yeah, I think I'll happily speak to that briefly if you think it's worthwhile. To be honest, I've had a terrific experience with this study. It was sponsored by Roche, the manufacturer of high-sensitivity cardiac troponin T. They had an independent chief investigator and a publications committee that's run by independent investigators, albeit with a Roche representative. My sub-study proposal to run this analysis was actually accepted from the outset. And in order to go ahead, I had to pre-specify my objectives, the methodology, the stats, the dissemination plan, etc. And once that was agreed and finalized, Roche sent me the entire data set. I ran all the statistical analyses myself and sent it to Roche's biostatistician once I'd finished for them to check the accuracy. After that, I drafted a manuscript. It wasn't anyone who had anything to do with Roche that drafted the manuscript. It was me. There were a couple of Roche employees as authors, I think, but they changed the manuscript actually relatively little. They, of course, suggested some additions. They had to meet the criteria for authorship, but they were relatively minor things. And ultimately, as the first author, I got to make the decisions about which suggestions we accepted. And of course, everyone had to approve it before submission. Roche did, of course, offer payment for writing and analysis, etc. But I think that's not unreasonable, as the whole sub-study took up a lot of my time. But I did decline the payment and even funded my own trip to Frankfurt for the investigator meeting, although they did pay for the hotel.
Well, I think that's really important that people know that you turned down the money. It shows just how complicated things can be. And it's not just as simple as reading a conflict of interest disclosure.
Yeah, absolutely. And in terms of this, I think it would have been justified to accept remuneration for the flights to get to Frankfurt. But I think it's more about external perception. It's what people might think of your research and whether they're going to trust it. And so it's always best, I think, to err on the side of caution when it comes to these things. If you start to develop a financial conflict of interest, then people might trust your findings a bit less. And I always want to be careful to try and avoid that kind of thing. So I know there's a lot of skepticism, rightly so, about industry-sponsored research. And when I was a kid, I remember discussing careers with my mum and dad and saying, for example, I couldn't be X. I can't remember what X was. Maybe it was a journalist or something, because there was so much corruption in that industry. And they said that maybe that's even more reason for someone who's got integrity to go into that line of work. And I've always bought into that, like that ideology. So now, as it happens, not by plan, but as it happens, I actually do a lot of work with industry, despite some of the bad press that it gets and the cynicism that it generates. And I figure that it's better to be involved, but to have integrity, so that we can all get some good out of it, rather than see all industry-sponsored research go to the dogs because only corrupt people do it. So that being so, I definitely don't buy into the idea that we can't trust any industry-sponsored work. There must be thousands of people with the same outlook as me, and hopefully I've managed to maintain my integrity with this work and advance the field a little.
I think that's for sure. You know, this sounds a lot like everything else in evidence-based medicine. The answer is always a little more complicated than it seems. At heart, I'm probably an idealist. I do think it's a very reasonable long-term goal to completely separate corporate money from research. But I can have that goal and still recognize that we need high-quality research funded right now. And I'm very happy that we have people like Rick who can continue to push forward our understanding of emergency medicine.
Okay, so let's comment on the author's conclusions and compare them to the SGEM's conclusions, Justin.
Well, we generally agree with the author's conclusions.
So can you give us a bottom line?
Well, high sensitivity troponin T is a new reality for some emergency physicians. We need to know how to use this test correctly to safely evaluate patients presenting with symptoms of ACS.
How about resolving the case that you presented?
Well, the patient is offered serial troponins and ECGs, but decides to go home knowing that there's no such thing as zero risk.
So how are you going to take Rick's new publication that's hot off the press and apply it clinically?
Well, the use of high sensitivity troponin T will all depend on your own personal comfort level, patient's preferences, and your current practice environment.
So how are you going to translate this to the bedside and talk to the patient?
Well, I would tell my patient that we cannot find any evidence of a heart attack right now. Your ECG is normal, and your blood work using a new, highly sensitive test is also normal. However, this does not mean that you didn't have a heart attack. There is a very small but real risk, less than 1%, that it could have been missed on ECG and blood test. It also doesn't mean that you don't have heart disease. It's possible that you could have a major adverse event, including death, in the next 30 days. That possibility is also very low, but not 0%. With these test results, less than 1 in 500 people die in the next 30 days, but 1% of people will have something that we call a major event, mostly meaning that they have to come back to the hospital and have some kind of heart intervention, like a stent or a surgery. Knowing that, would you like to stay for further testing in 1 to 3 hours, or would you like to go home now?
So Rick, you do all this research on high sensitivity troponin. How do you translate this at the bedside? What do you tell patients?
Well, I think if we could emulate what Justin just said, we'd be doing really well. That's a fantastic explanation. I think that you guys on the other side of the Atlantic are probably ahead of us when it comes to shared decision making. There's plenty of evidence from the US about the value of shared decision making. And I think we got a little bit of catching up to do. We're not quite as advanced as you in terms of how we involve patients in those decisions, but we're getting there. And I totally think that there's the future lies in explaining these risks to patients just as clearly as Justin has explained right now.
Well, you mentioned the U.S., and Corey's still listening here. So, Corey, what are you going to say at the patient's bedside to your U.S. population?
So, Ken, this is pretty much exactly what we would say to our patients below the border in America. Shared decision-making is a hot topic right now, and this is one area in which providing the patient information that you stated can help them come to a decision. In fact, my personal chest pain discharge instructions that I put into our EMR to get printed out to the patient includes very similar wording to what Justin said above.
Hello, SGEMers. My name is Jeff Klein, and I am the Editor-in-Chief of Academic Emergency Medicine. We are really interested in engaging the EM community and to find out what you think about this SGEM Hot Off the Press episode. What questions do you have for Dr. Bodie and his team on high-sensitivity troponin to rule out acute myocardial infarction? Join the conversation on Twitter, hashtag SGEMHOP, Facebook, or the SGEM blog. The best social media feedback will be published in AEM.
That sound reminds me that it's time to announce the Keener Contest winner from the last episode of season number 4. Karen Adler, a second-year medical student from Israel, knew the HAL 9000 computer sang Daisy Bell in the movie 2001 Space Odyssey. What's the question this week, Justin?
Ooh, well, this one's a really hard one for younger folks like me who've never seen anything but a troponin. But the question is, what was the first practical biomarker used for diagnosing MI?
Now, Rick, you and I are older, so I know you know the answer. I know you know that there was a world before troponin. But if anybody else out there listening knows the answer to this cardiac marker question, and it was mentioned on a previous episode of the SGEM, then send your answer to thesgem@gmail.com. And the first correct answer will receive that cool skeptical prize. Now, just briefly, a conference update. Falls View Beam in Niagara Falls, September 19th to 20th. And then I'm heading over to where Rick is, the Royal College of Emergency Medicine Annual Scientific Conference, September 20th to 22nd. Are we going to see each other there, Rick?
We certainly are. I'm really looking forward to it. The hashtag is Arkham Beach.
And then, of course, there's ASAP in Las Vegas this year, October 16th to 19th. Corey, are we going to see you in Vegas?
Unfortunately not, Ken. Vegas does not fit into my travel schedule for the year.
And then one other one is the teaching course with Rob Rogers. It's in New York City, November 14th to 16th. Well, thanks, Corey and AEM, for making the SGEM hot off the press even better with adding CME credits.
Thanks, Ken. Remember, listeners can head over to the AEM website, where on the left-hand side under Special Features is a link for Earn CME. This link will also be available on the SGEM website and in the show notes.
Justin, you were awesome filling Chris Carpenter's shoes.
Thanks. I know the SGEMers are going to miss Captain Cranium, but I will keep doing my best to help cut that knowledge translation window down from over 10 years to, well, I guess less than a week with the SGEM hop.
And Rick, we really appreciate you helping us cut that KT window down.
Well, let's hope that it really does make a difference to clinical practice.
Well, Rick, as the guest skeptic, you get to give the SGEM tagline.
Remember to be skeptical of anything you learn, even if you heard it on The Skeptic's Guide to Emergency Medicine.
Talk to everyone next time. I'll be your sensitive.